the new theater of the mind. The Bruce Collins Show.
Welcome back to the Bruce Collins Show. We're very glad to have you join us. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the sobering and horrific fact that 1 million kids are sex trafficked in the United States every year. Opal Singleton joins us tonight to talk about that subject. And we'll be discussing the mind-blowing amount of medical error that is prevalent in the United States and how you can protect yourself as Richard Stone joins us later. The Bruce Collins Show airs every Friday night at midnight right here at WWPR, 1490 AM. You can listen to past archives of The Bruce Collins Show at ipbn-fm.com. That's ipbn-fm.com. There's a banner just for The Bruce Collins Show on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network website. Click on the show banner and you will go right to our page. We would appreciate it if you're able to spread the word for our show by word of mouth, social media, or in whatever creative way you can. Also, we have a Facebook page for The Bruce Collins Show. Please like us there. And you can email the show at bruce_collins_show@aol.com. The Bruce Collins Show also has a YouTube channel. Visit YouTube, search for The Bruce Collins Show channel, subscribe, and catch all the latest shows on YouTube. Now, I know many of you maybe are coming across this show for the very first time, and you're saying, Bruce Collins, I seem to remember that name. And yes, I'm here to admit for the first time that several decades ago, I was one of the early pioneers of rap music. Now, I was doing a special kind of rap music that was unique then and is actually unique today. It's called medical rap. My album featured a head injury on the front cover, and the album name was Apply Ice Ice Baby. And some of you may remember my hit song back then. It was very controversial. My hit song was Mesothelioma. And now let me introduce my co-host, Chad Miles. He's a former congressional candidate in Michigan and a military veteran, and he's the founder and webmaster at Conspiria.net. You can also find out more information on Chad at chadmiles.com. He's radio's lethal weapon, Chad the Odometer Miles. Welcome back to the program, Chad.
You know, only people that are under 60 years of age, or over 60 years of age, will understand that mesothelioma joke. But anyway, hey, how are you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing pretty well, except I was just insulted. But did I ever tell you about the time I toured Mexico as a rap singer?
No, is that a true story?
You have to ask?
Well, half the time you talk about real events, and half the time you try to be witty. You're like a halfwit.
You're catching on.
Anyway, you were in Mexico?
Yeah. When I was a kid, well, at least I was younger, maybe not a kid, but when I was young, I toured Mexico as a rap artist.
Well, what did you sing?
Music.
You never told me about that.
Well, it was a lot of fun, but I did have a problem when I was there, and I don't mean the drinking water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? What happened?
I was supposed to appear at a large venue in Mexico City, but I ran into some trouble. Hey, Chad, has Senior Pickles ever been to Mexico City? Not New York City. Mexico City.
No, Senior Pickles is from Ohio.
Oh, that raises all kinds of questions.
Please continue.
Oh, okay. So, anyway, I was supposed to appear at a large auditorium, but I was shut out of the building.
What did you do?
Well, I looked around the perimeter of the building, and I finally found an open window, and I had to crawl through the window. When I got on the other side, though, there was a large bull and a guy dressed up like a bellhop.
You mean a matador?
No, not a matador. I said El Window.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, so here I am in this large pit with people cheering, and I'm surrounded by a bellhop and a bull. I could tell the bull wanted to charge me.
Wow, how could you tell he wanted to charge? Did he look mad or something?
No, he took out his credit card.
What?
Then the bellhop started jumping around with a couple shish kebabs in his hands.
Really? Then what happened?
I woke up.
Oh, you mean it was all a dream?
More like a nightmare. Have you ever had one of those, Chad?
Yeah, I'm going through one right now, I think.
You want me to come over there and shake you until you wake up?
Oh, if only that would work.
Ladies and gentlemen, while Chad is taking a nap, let me tell you that tonight Opal Singleton joins us to talk about her work against human sex traffickers, and Richard Stone joins us later to tell us how to avoid medical errors in a moment.
Bruce, you don't have to whisper.
Shh, quiet. Chad is asleep. Opal Singleton serves as the president and CEO of Million Kids, and she is the director of development for Rafa House International. As a retired business executive in international marketing, Opal understands that to win the battle to rescue and support victims of trafficking requires the creative resources of an entire community. She trains thousands of government agencies, school administrators, corporations, civic groups, and faith-based organizations about how to prevent human trafficking. Million Kids can be found online at millionkids.org. Opal's new book is Seduced, The Grooming of America's Teenagers. Now, the name of your organization is millionkids.org. If this was happening in the 70s, what would the name be? I mean, how many kids, is this problem mushrooming?
Yes, actually, even in the last month or two, I'm just kind of blown away by how fast this is progressing. When I started in 2010, we didn't really know what we were looking for. In fact, when I first started, I think I'm like most people, we assume this is all about foreigners coming in, foreign nationals. But what we find is in California, at least at this writing, 3 out of 4 cases, and this is pretty true across the United States, 3 out of 4 cases are U.S. citizens, and there are several things that are driving it. Would it have been like this in the 70s? Probably not, because you didn't have so much social media, and you didn't have the tremendous number of gangs that we now have. And so it's driven mainly by gangs recruiting kids in school, and also gangs recruiting through their own groups and people, especially if you get into like the Crips or you get into Mexican drug cartels. But it's also mainly driven because all kids are vulnerable that are on social media, and much of the grooming and recruiting is taking place on social media. So there are a mix of things driving it, but it is accelerating at just a mind-boggling pace.
Now, can you expand on that as far as the technology? How has our technology changed the ways that predators are stalking children?
Well, it really is a fascinating thing, which is why I wrote my book, Seduced, because I want parents to understand what is going on here. We really are at a unique time in history, if you think about this. For the first time in history, we have an entire generation of kids who have never not known the Internet. Now, kids before them knew the Internet, but they didn't have devices 24/7. And that's allowing the kids to live in kind of a secret world where they're all empowered. Then we have a generation of parents and grandparents that many are technophobic, and quite frankly, some of them are techno-impotent, if you will. And they don't realize what is happening. This makes a huge difference because the FBI will tell you that there are nearly 1 million predators online at any given time. In fact, when you hand a 10 or 12 year old a smartphone, they are, if they're a normal kid, going to access more strangers than you've probably known in your lifetime in less than a week because they're playing out there. There are over 3 billion people on the Internet, and that opens up all kinds of doors of opportunity for your child to be contacted by total strangers. Mm-hmm. the results of this is just staggering when you look at it. Think about this. Your child is now talking to people that you may never allow in your living room if you met them. And these people are giving input to your child on morality, spirituality, and sexuality. You know, it really is amazing when you stop and think about the way that technology has provided access to our children.
In your book, Seduced, again by Opal Singleton, you talk about digital morality. How is the technology impacting the morality of young people?
Actually, Bruce, that is why I wrote my book. It was just, I will tell you, the day I got up, I did not know I was going to write a book until that evening, because I had an event that just really struck me at school one day. It was December 17th, and it just really kind of ticked me off. And let me explain how this works. First of all, parents have to understand how online gaming works, but all the kids these days are into online gaming. Some of it is more violent, more sexual than others, but we all know that most of the kids either love Grand Theft Auto. Most of them either want it or they have it. I've done surveys where as many as 70% of the kids in the audience have Grand Theft Auto, and they have never been a beacon of morality. Okay, never. You've always had prostitutes, you've always killed cops, that's the way it is. So that's what kids love about it. But in this year's model, they have something called first-person experience software. And in this particular game, you have sex with a prostitute. Now, the kids will know exactly what we're talking about, but I'm not going to say it on the air. But the sex act, you actually pay for it with your bitcoins. It's, you know, 20 bucks for this, 50 bucks for that, 70 bucks for this. And when you're through having your first person experience with the prostitute, you kill her so you can get your money back. So I was training kids. I guess I haven't told you the part that I am a trainer for law enforcement, and I go into school. So I was training this young man, and I asked him, I said, so did you do the deal with the prostitute? And he said, oh, yeah, this is cool. And I'm like, well, you know, how do you feel about that? And he says, what do you mean? And I said, well, hold it here. You just told me that you had sex with a prostitute. First person experienced sex with this prostitute, you paid your money, and then you killed her. Don't you feel bad? And this kid goes, why? It's a game. It's what you got to do to win. And that's just simply amazing. I hope parents out there in your audience really get the impact of what's happening here. Because I've now asked many, many kids, and they will all tell you, you know, it's just a game. It's what you have to do to win. And I'm like, well, how about killing a cop, you know? Well, yeah, I backed up twice and killed him, you know, and you don't feel bad? No, you have to do that to win. And what they're really telling you is that sex on the Internet is not sex, and that killing on the Internet is not killing. And, in fact, they're really telling you that morality does not count.
Yeah.
Now, here's why this is really, really dangerous. It just blew my mind the first time I heard it and why I wrote my book. Because they're really telling you that the decisions they're making on the Internet don't count. That as long as it's just a fantasy, it doesn't matter. But I'm going to tell you that's not true, because I work in cases of sex trafficking and what we call sextortion, which is blackmail with a naked photo or an illicit photo. And what happens to these kids is they get in there, they start playing these games, and then they connect with somebody and they want a photo. This, by the way, is how boys get exploited, because they think they're talking to a girl, but it isn't a girl, it's a guy. And they shoot that photo off, and that photo goes off to a guy who puts it on a porn ring, and all of a sudden, he's being approached by hundreds of guys who want to have sex with him. Now, he made the decision in a world of fantasy where it didn't count. But the end result is he will become exploited, because it is the real world and your actions do count. So that's digital morality. And I want parents to read this book and understand the impact that's going to have on raising your child.
This also taps into a chapter you have about the numbing down of America and something you call the Tetris effect, doesn't it?
Yes, actually, I deal quite a bit with online gaming in my book. I also talk about apps and various chat rooms, which are important also. But gaming is really an interesting thing because most parents don't understand that many video games have chat rooms in there. And the reason why that's so important is that they're living and breathing in these chat rooms with the games. You see, gaming isn't like taking your kid to a movie. What will happen in there is you get involved with a game, you build a character, and you give that character a name, you buy it tattoos, you use your bitcoins to buy equipment, and you compete for approval in a world of violence and advancing sex, by the way, because you're into animated sex and it gets into animated pornography. But the key here, the scary part here, is that you need the approval of your guild and your guild manager. So that makes it very, very competitive and why so many kids are becoming addicted to gaming. Because think about this, they in their mind think that they've found something they're really good at. They quit playing sports, they quit socializing, they start to live and breathe in this world because they can get that instant gratification from the people in their chat rooms. The problem with that is that you never let it go. And what you're referring to, that's a long explanation for Tetris effect, but what you're referring to is if you've ever taken your kid out to dinner and they don't talk to you, they just sit there, even if they don't have your device in their hand where they can play, they're still off in space. That's because in their mind, they're still playing the game because they know the game is going on when they're not there. And they're competing for approval. If you only have a 40 or 50 in your score, nobody wants to play with you. So in your mind, you keep competing until you can get back to your game and initiate your plays. So this has a way of grooming your children, of changing their thought processes. But more importantly, think about this. If your child's playing on a game, let's say 4 hours a night, these games are highly addictive. They get into a lot, they're set in a world of occult and sorcery, and they get into animated pornography. But more important, for 4 hours a night, other people are talking to your child that needs their approval, and they're talking to them while they're in a fantasy. It is an absolute incubator for grooming, and I can share with you, I do share with you in the book, case after case where this goes wrong.
You mentioned quite a number of things in your book that I was not aware of. Quite a few, I guess, internet pages. I'm aware of Facebook, AOL, things like that. But you talk about Kick and Omegle. What kind of applications should parents be looking for that kids are into that maybe are a bigger gateway to these predators?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because those specific two are probably two of the biggest culprits in grooming. And, you know, you're most of the time parents are on Facebook and they are a friend of their child and they think they're keeping an eye on their child. But truthfully, kids have left Facebook in pretty big numbers. And what happens is they bounce around from app to app, so it's very hard to track this. But one of the biggest apps out there is called Kick, K-I-K. And it can be okay if they limit the number of people that they talk to. In other words, if they only take emails or instant messaging, it's actually an instant messaging app is what it is. If they only are talking only to people they know, then your kid's probably okay. But Kick is one of the biggest things out there for kids. It has about 200 million users. I recently did a survey of high school kids. It was a written survey. Of 150 kids, 80% were on Kick. 80% had received a message from a stranger. That's 80%, a message from a stranger. 50% replied to that stranger, and 3 went out and met them. The reason I took that survey is we had a beautiful 14-year-old girl over here. And I'll tell you, Bruce, until you've been through something like this, you can't appreciate what I'm about to say. But I sit with parents who are missing their kids because I work with law enforcement and I do a lot of training. In this case, this man had bought his 14-year-old daughter a smartphone. He had never been on a computer. They were somewhat poor. And he said, right in his own living room, maybe even in the back seat of his car, she went on Kick and she hooked up with a guy that was 19. She's 14. One day, she got mad at mom and dad. They dropped her off at school, and she snuck out to the mall to meet this guy. And he was a really bad pimp. He took her over to L.A. and sold her into the Crip street gang. And for 9 weeks, one of my hobbies is looking for kids that are missing. It isn't just a hobby. I do this because the parents are terribly upset. But for 9 weeks, I did everything I could to find that girl on the Internet. Eventually, she was found being sold into, you know, sex trafficking on the Internet. But it all happened because she hooked up on Kick. One of the things that we found out about Kick at that point was that their server is in Ontario, Canada. At that time, they would not respond to subpoenas, so law enforcement could not find out who the boyfriend was that she ran off to meet. Now, today, they're telling us that they are trying to be more cooperative. I can't prove that, but at the time, they were absolutely uncooperative. But that is just huge to have so many kids hooking up with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Let me share with you about Omegle, because I want parents to understand that, and it is in my book, because we have case after case where kids are disappearing on Omegle. What has happened on the Internet has become very large and very fast, and it's increased bandwidth. So now we have all of these video social media chat rooms. And what happens is, when your kid's at home alone, while you're off at work, your child can meet up with a total stranger on a video chat room. In fact, the word Omegle, by the way, is spelled O-M-E-G-L-E for those out there. And their logo is Talk with Strangers. You sign up for this, and it allows the next random video live streaming to come into your living room or into your kid's device. And they hook up. And I would recommend that parents do YouTube of Omegle and watch some of these, and you will be appalled at how young the kids are. Some of these kids are 8, 9, 10 years old, hooking up with strangers on video chat rooms where they can talk on there. And it's frightening to look at. If you're going to go on YouTube and look at Omegle, I would highly recommend that you turn the sound down, because they only know a few words that begin with F, and some of them have single-digit IQs, okay?
Yeah.
They are not the most intellectual people. But the danger here is that your child hooks up with somebody they're attracted to. And one of the things that me and Kids is doing, and I'm hoping people will donate to our organization so that we can actually get more resources to set this up, but I'm in the process of setting up on the millionkids.org webpage a training tutorial that will have the various apps, and it will actually have linked to it all the various cases where predators have been charged in a case where they've actually used that app or game or social media site to exploit a young person. So I'm in the process of building that. I need more resources to do it. But I think that's really important, so that a parent, if they see their child in Omegle, could go to my website, pull up Omegle, and see all the different ways that a predator's used to violate a child.
You would think, with a million kids being sex trafficked every year, that everybody would be up in arms and our politicians would be receptive to what's going on. What do you hear from politicians? Is this an issue for them?
Well, it's fast becoming an issue because of the rate that this is growing. It was interesting, when I first started this in 2010, I could hardly get anybody to listen to me because they were sure I was talking about foreigners. Today, now, you'll see these on specials across the nation, MSNBC, CNN, Fox. They're all running specials about how serious this is becoming. But what they still haven't caught on to is just how serious this is for the average kid. And quite frankly, even myself in the last 3 or 4 months have been appalled at how fast this is growing. And so you are getting a lot more of your legislators involved. In fact, President Obama signed a declaration about it. The Catholic Church has, and like that, even United Way this last week, because all of a sudden people are starting to realize just how prevalent this is and that it can happen to any child. And that is where now my book is so timely because, you know, I've been doing this for 5 years. I sit with real cases, and that's why it's important that we understand. Let me share with you a trend that has happened just in the last 2 weeks, actually the last week, that is just, it's terrifying to me, and I'm pretty tough. I work in this business. Mm-hmm. But I think parents need to know. But there's been 3 things that have happened this week that are just amazing. One is kids, when they get into prostitution, are sold on something called Backpage, Backpage. Well, I was excited because they quit taking credit cards to place ads for people for sale, except now they take bitcoins. Well, who has bitcoins? Kids who play video games, okay? The very next day, Facebook announces that they're going to do money transfers. Well, that's that, you know, anybody that can do money transfers through Facebook, they're going to be hard to track. Actually, it'll lend itself to money laundering. But the very next day after that, it came out now that kids are getting really big into camming. Now, that's a short word for video camming. And what is happening where kids before were just sexting, meaning they were sending texts back and forth that were raunchy and very explicit and like that, now a child can go to their bedroom and make a pornographic video of themselves and put it out there. They can go in there and do live streaming of making their own porn and sending it out. A girl can have her boyfriend sell it, and they can take bitcoins to charge for it. So you're starting to see a nation of young people that are out there making their own first of all, they're making pornographic selfies, and now they can do pornographic live streaming and collect money for it through bitcoins. So this is going to change the porn industry, the prostitution industry. While I'm on a roll here, let me share one more fact with you. There is technology now to intercept photos of naked children. This is what the FBI and other organizations do when they're looking for child pornography. Since that technology started, there has been intercepted 130 million naked images of children. Listen to this number, Bruce. This is amazing. One-fourth of these naked photos were sent by the child themselves. That's 32 million naked photos. Wow. You talk about what you do on the Internet doesn't have consequences. These kids are out sending naked photos to a boyfriend or a girlfriend, or now they can actually live stream it and sell it for pornography and use the Bitcoin account from their game. This is a crazy world we live in.
And again, we're speaking with Opal Singleton. She's the author of Seduced, The Grooming of America's Teenagers. She's also the president and CEO of Million Kids. And you can find out more information about Million Kids at millionkids.org. Now, considering all of that, that it's overwhelming. Do you think that internet regulations are in order?
Well, I don't think internet regulations are going to change it. And quite frankly, it's a real challenge for what a parent to do. Internet regulations, I mean, first of all, it hasn't changed pornography. They're still sending that stuff out there.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can legislate our way through this. The real key here is putting the power back into parenting. You see, what has happened is that all of this has happened around the parent, and they have kind of a thin veil or a fog around them now that these kids all have the devices. Now, first of all, in my opinion, when you hand a 10 or 12-year-old a phone, many of these parents are doing this before they even have the sex talk with the child. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Yeah.
If you hand a 10-year-old a video game that has a chat room in it, you might as well take your 10-year-old down to a strip club and leave them off. Mm-hmm. Because you may not realize that's what you're doing, but that's what you're doing when you hand a 10-year-old a video game with a chat room. And so parents aren't thinking this out. This is why my book is just so critical, to get this out to parents, to help them think through this. The other thing is they aren't going to be able to control their child just by, you know, keeping your child away from technology. You're going to have to join this century. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you that technology is bad, but it's no different than sending your 12-year-old out with the family car. You would not do that unless you were with your child and you knew that they were capable of making good decisions. But what a parent is doing is they hand a device and then they walk away and hope and pray that it's going to be okay. They must get engaged with that child. If their child has a video game already, step with the child. See what they're looking at. Who are they talking to? Talk to the child. If your child were playing soccer, you would go to the soccer game. So why is it different because it's electronic? We need to take a whole new look at this. How do we handle it? Talk to your child about morality. You know, if your child's in there having sex with a prostitute, it's time for you to overcome your shyness and sit with your child because you probably bought him that game. You know, you're partially responsible if you make a decision to hand your child a video game that's full of sex, full of violence, and also opens the door to allow strangers to groom your child. So I'm telling you, get involved and start a dialogue. Buy the book, read the book. By the way, the book is a 5-star book on Amazon, and it's, quite frankly, if you buy it from me and kids, more of the money will go towards our work, but you can buy it on Amazon. But it will tell you in there, you know, the various scenarios and the kinds of questions to ask and the kind of dialogue to have. And when all is said and done, there's nothing wrong with the word no.
Yeah.
You are still the parent in the bottom when it comes down to it. And you're still responsible because you probably bought that device for him in the first place.
You know, I know you're a person of faith. I'm a person of faith. Many of my listeners are people of faith. We're our brother's keeper. So if one of our listeners suspects someone is being trafficked, what should they do?
Oh, they need to report it as soon as possible. But I'm happy to hear that your audience is, many of them are faith-based, because I'm going to tell you that if God is not the answer to this problem, there is no answer. And I talk about that in my book, because I believe it's going to take people of morality, people with standards, people with the guts of leadership to come forward and say, this is wrong. We cannot lose an entire generation of our kids. I believe that how we're handling this today, since this is really the first generation of a new era of electronics, how parents, especially Christian parents, decide to handle this in their parenting and leadership is going to determine the future generations for years to come, because these kids, not very long from now, will be having kids of their own. And it really is important for us to stop and say that we need to begin to raise a generation of young people that have strong moral ethics and will have strong moral leadership, because these electronics are accelerating daily, almost, on how kids are being exploited. And that is true of games, that is true of cyberbullying, that is true of these chat rooms where they're hooking up, and it is going to take the faith-based community to decide that they're going to wake up and assume responsibility for this and take a leadership role. What an opportunity to take a look at this and develop strong moral leaders in our children.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to happen by accident. You need a strategy, and you need to understand the problem.
As your book points out, one of the things you can do if you believe that someone you know is being trafficked is to call 1-800-373-7888. Again, that's 1-800-373-7888. That's the National Human Trafficking Hotline. And again, that's in this book, Seduce, The Grooming of America's Teenagers by Opal Singleton. Now, Opal, in closing, what can people find at your website, millionkids.org? And also, how can they support you and your organization?
Well, first of all, I'd like to encourage people to go to the Million Kids Facebook page. That is the best education you will get across America. We post new cases about every 3 to 4 hours, and we post national cases, so it doesn't matter where you live. The second thing is go to our webpage, www.millionkids, that's M-I-L-L-I-O-N, millionkids.org, and go to our training blog that we're building. And if they want to support us with a donation, we would be very, very grateful. We need additional resources to build this website, to get that information out there, and to be able to educate people. So the most important thing, buy the book, read the book, and do what we suggest in the book. Get involved. Look at our Facebook page. That's Me and Kids Riverside on Facebook. And go to our webpage. And if you want to donate, God bless you. We desperately need it. We are going 70 hours a week getting this website built. The website is up, but what we're trying to do is get the training information on there specific to each app and game and social media site.
Again, we've been speaking with Opal Singleton. She's the author of Seduced, The Grooming of America's Teenagers. I highly recommend this book. And please go to her website tonight, millionkids.org. That's millionkids.org. And joining me this week is Richard Stone. Richard Stone is the Chief Innovation Officer of Sinensis, a healthcare consulting firm dedicated to helping hospitals achieve zero preventable harm, and is a nationally recognized speaker on the power of storytelling. Over the last 20 years, he has developed story-based programs for team building, leadership development, and diversity training for hospitals, and has worked nationally with hospice volunteers and staff through his program, Journey into the Healing Power of Storytelling. Rick is also the author of 3 books, The Healing Art of Storytelling, Stories, The Family Legacy, and The Kingdom of Knout, as well as the publisher of the award-winning board game Pitch a Story. Richard Stone has co-authored a new book with Stephen Powell called The Patient Survival Handbook, Avoid Being the Next Victim of Medical Error. And I recommend this book. I've read this book. It's The Patient Survival Handbook, again by Richard Stone and Stephen Powell. Richard Stone, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Hey, thank you for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Now, you have co-authored this new book with Stephen Powell, and of course it's called The Patient Survival Handbook. Why did you write this book?
Well, we were experts in patient safety, and we work on one side of the fence, which is working with healthcare professionals to make hospitals and healthcare safer. But we have become sorely aware that patients need to be engaged with their own care and can play a big role in making healthcare safer if they are engaged. So we wanted to share our wisdom that we've learned through all the many difficult things that we've seen and helped to try to improve, and share that wisdom with patients and families, because we think there are a lot of things that they can do to ensure that they stay safe. And it's a big problem. Patients are being harmed at enormous rates in this country. And so the more eyes and ears that are attending to the issue, the more likely it is that we can make a dent in that problem.
And how prevalent is medical error today?
Well, there's lots of estimates that are out there. About 15 years ago, the Institute of Medicine came out and said that hospitals were killing 98,000 people a year. the more recently, the people went back and looked at that data and said, don't think we counted right. It may be closer to 300 to 400,000 people, which makes medical error in hospitals, the number three killer in America. So unfortunately, most of us are very unaware of how unsafe hospitals are, and that's just people who have died through preventable harm. Millions of people are actually being harmed through medication errors and a whole range of other errors that happen, and luckily they're not killed, and often they can recover. But some people are being harmed irreparably as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, big problem.
5 years ago, my mother, she was 74 at the time, she had cancer surgery, and she's still alive, she's still with us, and she's much better. And she went to the hospital, and I noticed that the nurses were working really hard. In fact, they seemed to be understaffed. And one of the nurses said that the hospital was thinking about, in addition to that, cutting half of the staff beyond what it was at that point. What is the major problem? Why is this happening today?
Well, staffing is an issue, and there's no question about it. And I think hospitals often have the wrong end of the stick around this issue. Years ago, I was working with a hospital, and hospitals often set up kind of a standard. They might say four patients or five patients per nurse. And I was talking to a chief nursing officer at one of the top healthcare facilities in the country, and she got very upset about these kinds of formulas. And she said at their hospital, they look at two things, but the first thing they look at mostly is acuity, and what that means is how sick are you. So it might be that you're so sick, one nurse might have to devote all their time just to you. And another news, you might have six or seven patients who have very low acuity. They don't have a lot of needs. And one nurse could manage six or seven. So these kinds of formulas, I think California's actually set that in law. They're actually dangerous from that perspective. There's a lot of research that also says that the education of the nurses, the level of education they have, is a big predictor. Can actually impact whether you survive or not. It actually improves survival rate from serious harm. So staffing is a big issue. But the bigger issue that is really prevalent in healthcare today is the breakdown of teamwork and communication. And when Joint Commission, which is one of the big accrediting bodies, researched sentinel events, big events where people are who die. 70% of the time, they've attributed those problems to poor teamwork and poor communication, poor leadership. And so, there's a lot of communication going on in healthcare today. And sometimes very fractured. And, your handoff from the emergency room to the ICU or to another floor, sometimes crucial things are not communicated. Even the handoff at shift change. Is a dangerous time for a patient. So we think because of this, patients and families need to be more engaged with the process because things are fractured. You might have five different doctors consulting on your care, and they're not talking to each other. They come in independently, they examine you, and they put something in the medical record, and the next guy comes along or gal comes along, and they may not even refer to that note and read it in detail. And so coordination of care is also a big challenge.
What type of advice do you have in terms of primary care?
Well, all of us at some time go to see a physician for whatever ails us. And so the first thing that to know is that doctors, they're also under a lot of pressure to see lots of patients. And that creates a culture of quick decisions and diagnosis. And I don't know if your listeners know, I'll ask you the quiz. This is always an interesting question. How long do you think it takes the average physician to arrive at a diagnosis, Bruce?
Probably 5 minutes.
Well, you're far away, 18 seconds.
Wow.
Okay, so you begin telling, you say, hey, doc, you know, I just woke up this morning and my back is a... Within 18 seconds, the doctor, he's drawn a conclusion and has stopped listening. It's also, there's been some interesting research that says that if he stops and listens for about 2 minutes, most of us will do a pretty good job of synopsizing all of the things that are going on with us. So sometimes doctors will quickly arrive at a conclusion that's the wrong conclusion. And it's become part of the culture of the way they think. So one of the things that we can always ask the question, it's a very simple, so we need to be prepared with good questions. And a good one is, hey, doc, what else might it be? Could it be something else? And that gives the doctor a reason to pause and say, well, it could be, you know, there could be two or three other things. And so the question is, how confident or how sure are you that it's the thing that you said it is? And a good physician will say, well, I'm not completely, say, tell me a little more about what's going on for you. So now you've suddenly asked the doctor to sort of interrupt what is a bad habit, essentially. So we need to be prepared when we go to our primary doctor or a primary care physician is that, ask good questions. Ask them, you know, why, you know, what is it, what's wrong with me? What's the plan? What do you want me to do here? And why do you want me to do this? Why will this help me get better? See, these are all questions that are important to ask. And so we can't be passive and just, go in and then you'll get home and your spouse will say, well, what did the doctor say? And sometimes another problem is, well, I can't remember. Yeah. So sometimes it's very good to take a spouse or a friend with us because it's not even a matter of being old. It's a matter of, sometimes it's complicated and it's hard to remember all the things that the physician's going to tell you.
Now, Richard, what should our listeners know in terms of keeping safe during hospitalization?
Well, there's lots of things to know. First of all, you can't assume that your care is coordinated. That's a dangerous assumption. And when you're going into the hospital, you need to be prepared to become actively engaged in what's going on with your care. So you can't even presume that everyone's following safety protocols. So, for example, hand washing. We know that washing hands prevents infection spread. Mm-hmm. And so one of the most important things is for you to be vigilant. And if you see that a caregiver comes in and has not washed their hands in front of you, because there's a sink in your room, you have to ask in a very polite way, said, have you washed your hands? And if they haven't, ask them, you know, I'm aware that hand washing is important. Would you mind? And there's actually some data out there that says that by the end of the shift, people get lazier about washing hands, especially if it's a long 12-hour shift. So we need to be prepared with that. And then you always have to ask the question when someone they come with a medication, what is the medication? Why am I taking that? Why did the doctor prescribe this? And if it looks like something different than what had been prescribed and what you took yesterday, then you need to be certain that it's the right medication. And it's the right dosage of the medication. So there are lots of things that can go wrong in that setting, and we can't assume that everyone is constantly vigilant. And I mean, these are all good, well-meaning people, but they get exhausted, and we know what happens when we're tired. We don't think as well. We don't make as good decisions, and so we have to be really on our game as well, or our family member or someone who's with us needs to be on their game.
Now, you have tips in your book, and again, the book is The Patient Survival Handbook, regarding pre-op and post-op surgery safety. Can you touch on some of these?
Well, yeah. So if any of you have gone in for surgery, I've been in pre-op before. You know, you have to be clear on, you know, what are the pre-op instructions? And I think that it's often it's a confusing thing. You're supposed to show up at the hospital at 6 in the morning and not have eaten the night before. So you have to be very clear on what the pre-op instructions are and what are the things that you're being asked to do to prepare best for surgery. And then the post-op, if you're discharged, you know, there's so much surgery is being done in ambulatory settings where, you know, you go in the morning and you're out by 2 o'clock and you go home. So it's very important to know what is it that I need to do, or if I'm the caregiver, what do I as the caregiver need to do in for the person's recovery? And how do I ensure, whether it's wound care or whatever is involved with my care, what are the steps in? Am I clear exactly on the medications that I'm supposed to be taking and when I'm supposed to be taking the medications? And probably most importantly, how do I know if maybe I'm getting an infection? What are the things that I need to look for that could be problematic so that I can immediately call my physician and get in to be seen either in the ER or go back to the physician's office if there's any questions about an infection and what would be the signs of an infection? Because that's how people get sepsis, which is a systemic infection, which is very quickly can cause death. So these are the kinds of things you just need to do to be prepared for.
Now, your book also talks about when you're after you're discharged from the hospital, how can you stay safe at home?
Well, I think the crucial thing is knowing what the care plan is. And so often at discharge, a nurse will come in and they'll quickly go over all the 45 things that you need to do to take care of yourself. They'll give you a bunch of papers and they say, "You have any questions?" Well, you don't even know what to ask. And so you get home and now you're not sure. So it's very crucial at the time of discharge is to have someone there asking questions. And then the question is, what's the follow-up and who should I be following up with? Should I be going back to see my primary care physician? Are my records being sent to my primary care physician? You know, we have a phenomena today, which maybe some of your listeners have experienced, is that when you go into the hospital, your primary care physician often is not coming to the hospital to see you any longer. That day is gone. They have a new kind of doctor called a hospitalist who is resident at the hospital, who is in charge of your coordinating your care there at the hospital. So that person doesn't know anything about you. All they have is maybe your medical record, and they maybe have not studied that in depth. And then your primary care physician doesn't know anything about what's happened to you in the hospitals until you show back up on their doorstep. And so you need to be certain that they are getting the records and they have a complete picture so that they can ensure that you have good aftercare.
And the book is excellent. I really enjoyed this book, and I know our listeners will also. It's the Patient Survival Handbook, Avoid Being the Next Victim of Medical Error, by Stephen Powell and Richard Stone. And we've been speaking with Richard Stone. Before you go, Richard, is there anywhere on the Internet, do you have an online footprint anywhere that people can go
to? Yes, we do. Yeah, so there's some resources we have. Our website is www.thepatientsurvivalhandbook.com. And they can go there, and there's more resources there, as well as they can order the book there, or they can get it in all the usual places like Amazon. You can go onto Amazon and do the Patient Survival Handbook, or Barnes & Noble, or iTunes, and you can download the electronic version as well. So the book's available and out there and accessible right now.
Excellent. Richard, this has been a treat. Thank you so much for joining me this week.
Oh, I really appreciate you taking the time to have me on your show. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for joining us here at the Bruce Collins Show, where you can find us every Friday night at midnight here at WWPR 1490 AM. Remember, God loves you. We do too. Don't give up.